From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We are joined, as always, with our super producer, Alexis Tombstone Jackson. That's a nickname we're all quite taken with today, but it may change in the future. Let us know your suggestions. Most importantly, you are here, and that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. In a way, this is our recurring listener mail segment that we're doing every week as we are recording this. It is July 27th. This is the part of the show where we put our money where our mouth is. From the very early days of YouTube, Matt and I always said and emphasized that you, specifically you, are the best part of this show. So let's put some action behind that idea. Here we go. We're going to hear from you, specifically you.
Hey, guys. Just wanted to call up. I don't know if you guys have seen or read or heard about all the rumors of instituting martial law during this coronavirus outbreak, the COVID-19. I just want to say, as somebody who used to work logistics in the Army, that the military as a whole does not have the manpower to actually institute a nationwide martial law. The fact that it's spreading around is very disturbing, honestly. And in cases where the National Guard or the Army need to be activated, or any other branch for that matter, need to be activated to set up, you know, mobile hospitals or help to distribute food or provide any other relief work, they might run into situations where, you know, local populations who are misinformed about why they're there might try to fight off the people trying to come and help them. Or, maybe I'm completely misinformed. I don't know. You guys keep up the good work. Take care, guys. Bye.
Wow. Okay. Well, thank you for calling in. First of all, I want to say that this call came in April of this year. So several months ago, when there were a lot of rumors floating around social media and the internet at large about martial law being instated due to the quarantine that was in place, the kind of not initial, but the early quarantine and responses to the coronavirus and COVID-19 and the outbreak.
Yeah.
So you have to kind of put everything that was just stated in that context. And in that context, you can imagine how, I think we even spoke about it a few times in our episodes on coronavirus, how there, it feels like there's this potential with all of this, because it was feeling so unprecedented at the time to be in a quarantine, especially in the United States, or at least within the United States. It felt like something that had never happened. And it felt so different. The economy was in a pretty steep decline. There was so much uncertainty, I think, early on, especially then in April, that there was a general sense that perhaps the military or someone will need to come through and do some kind of damage control by way of security forces. But it also felt like that would be something that would not be welcomed, or we would be excited at all about.
Well, not only that, though, caller was implying that it wouldn't be feasible based on the powers of the presidency, perhaps, or also just on the logistics of getting this done in a wide-scale thing. And it's interesting because until you said the context of this timing-wise, Matt, I assumed the caller was referring to exactly what we're seeing happening right now in Portland, Oregon, and has been promised to happen soon in places like Chicago and Albuquerque. Well, there was another place that was listed as the potential site for where the administration wanted to send some of these federal forces in order to, they're calling it tamp down widespread criminality and reintroduce the quote-unquote rule of law.
No, I see exactly what you're saying, Noel, because I think it's a perfect way to talk about it right now. Looking at some of the video that's coming out of Portland right now, where there are federal agents out there operating in place of, you know, the Portland Police Department or some other local force, even the National Guard. That's not what we're looking at here in Portland right now in, what is it, the end of July 2020? We're looking at Border Patrol agents, at least that's, I maybe would use the word allegedly, who is out there, because that's the way it's been discussed, you know, by the federal government, by the administration, that these would be the officers going out there, or the, I guess not off, the soldiers that are being deployed there with the explicit purpose to protect federal buildings. It's just very odd because it comes a week after, like all of this right now, we're talking about it a week after there were reports of soldiers essentially, or unmarked officers of some sort or another in camouflage, taking protesters into unmarked vehicles and carting them away somewhere. And, you know, when you're discussing fears of martial law, that type of action, abducting a civilian essentially without knowing what's occurring to that citizen, either by that citizen or their friends or family or surrounding people, and just not knowing what's going to happen to them after they're being abducted, that is nightmare scenario territory, at least for me.
So I appreciate this call immensely. And I believe for fellow listeners, one thing that is important for us to do whenever we talk about martial law is to define it and bust some myths that are widely propagated, both online and in print and terrestrial journalism. First things first, the imposition of martial law, and I've said this on previous episodes for years, the imposition of martial law is the idea that military forces will take over the authority and functions of civilian government. This is not unique to the U.S. This has happened in plenty of other countries, Pakistan, Thailand. Our pals over at House of Works have a great article on this. But martial law has never in the history of the U.S. been imposed on a nationwide basis. And to your point, caller, part of that is a hard constraint on people power and on resources. Martial law is technically allowed by the U.S. Constitution, but most constitutional experts say that federal law will bar the military from seizing authority over any area inside U.S. borders except for extreme instances. And this is what has a lot of people worried, because extreme instances include something like a rebellion against federal rule or a situation in which local and state rule breaks down, meaning your municipal or citywide government is unable to uphold rule of law. Scary times. But what's important here is that people who are worried about the fascist tactic of federal agents without accountability detaining people in unmarked vans. But part of the worry here is the idea that the current government at a federal level could be creating the problem that they later purport to solve by pushing an existing situation into becoming a situation where the federal government can say with a straight face, there is a rebellion, right? To your point, Matt, about federal agents officially being there just to protect federal buildings. So I think there are a lot of misconceptions. Martial law has happened here in regions, in cities, you know what I mean? And it's not, to your point, Noel, it's not always a situation where there are a bunch of stormtroopers mowing down women and children. There are hospitals, right? There are other municipal services that martial law can do. But interestingly enough, for anyone who feels like this is politically divisive, you might be intrigued to note that among the people saying it's against American law to have martial law are people like Dov Zakheim, who is the former Undersecretary of Defense under, wait for it, George W. Bush. So people on both sides of the aisle, you know, when you look at the facts, they're very, very against the idea of nationwide martial law. Part of it is because it's a terrible indicator of a political situation domestically. And another part is, as you said, a resource question.
Well, it's also something like we're used to seeing National Guard come in when people need help, like, say, a natural disaster, or like, you know, Hurricane Katrina, or the idea of sending in the troops, or, you know, doctors or makeshift medical care facilities to help people who are desperately in need. It's a hard sell to say that that's what's going on right now. It feels like a bit more of a stretch to say, okay, people need help, therefore we're sending in, you know, these unidentified troops and militaristic type forces to quote unquote help people by shoving them into vans. And even, you know, we've seen examples during a lot of these protests where there are folks out there supplying free water and medical care for folks that are out there protesting, and seeing some of these military forces actually trashing said setups. You know, there have been lots of videos circulating, and I mean, it's, you know, many of these certainly could be looked at as isolated incidents, but I saw a very shocking one where some of these riot police and National Guard type folks were absolutely stomping all over bottled waters and medical packets and, you know, just trashing these tents that folks who were peacefully sitting there were there to help people if they needed medical attention. So it seems like what we're seeing is kind of the opposite of what this was intended for, but that's just, you know, to my eyes.
Well, you know, in this specific case that we're discussing in Portland right now in July 2020, the explicit purpose of the deployment of those Border Patrol agents that are there in the city is to protect that federal courthouse, which is at the center, one of the main areas where the demonstrations are occurring, right? And it is not to aid, it is to provide security forces with a militarized group, right? A militarized team, essentially, or teams. And it is appears to be a response, as Ben, you were saying, to the protesting that is occurring on a nationwide scale. We're recording this on Monday, July 27th. And as of last Thursday, the administration, the sitting executive, stated that there were 75,000 federal officers that were ready to go. And the quote here from The Guardian is, "We'll go into all of the cities, any of the cities, we're ready."
So there's an interesting point here. I want to rely heavily on facts in these kind of conversations, because there are a lot of people who are scared, rightly terrified. So the Posse Comitatus Act, which you've mentioned on previous episodes, longtime listeners, this will be familiar to you, is a statute in the U.S. from 1878. And long story short, or TLDR, as we say on Reddit, it in most instances bars military forces from being used in law enforcement activities. One thing that's very important here is that, legally speaking, the I'll just call them stormtroopers for funsies. The federal forces that are involved in these protests and uprising now are not themselves military, because posse comitatus means that the U.S. military, they can't be a police force. It's something that a bunch of people in the U.S. like wrote down and agreed on, and that's been the case since 1878. So you have to be careful when people from various spheres are arguing that there is an army happening. There is militarization of police, and that's been going on for a long, long time. And then there's also this idea of the role that the National Guard plays, which I think you make a very good point with. This means that many of the people who are talking about the idea of nationwide martial law, like the same time, you know, when people were worried about FEMA taking over or worried about Jade Helm, this hinges on a misconception. But as I mentioned in previous episodes, the problem with rule of law is that if the people in power, I'd like to say people responsible to the public, that's really what they are. If the people responsible to the public are not obeying the laws, then those are rules for a game that we're no longer playing. So I don't know. There's so much misinformation. Martial law ends up being a thought-terminating cliche because a lot of people who talk about it don't understand what the real-life deployment of it is. And of course, this just applies to the U.S. If you are listening in another country, your individual mileage may vary.
So we're definitely going to, you know, continue to keep our eye on this. We would just urge as you were saying, Ben, caution when you're reading a social media post about this, or even as we're reading here from The Guardian, if you're reading any reporting on this, just be cautious that someone isn't trying to make you feel one way or another about it, and stick hard to the facts. But when you see federal agents, you know, in your city, let us know, and let us know what they're doing, I guess, because I think we would probably trust something coming from you more than we would from the New York Times or any other publication. So please call us, write to us, find us on social media, tell us what's going on in your neck of the woods. And with that, we're going to take a quick word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Our next listener mail I pulled from a caller by the name of Victoria, who has some questions about the origin of a very peculiar type of hygiene ritual.
Hi, I just finished listening to your episode on the nuclear incident that was released, I think, in May, so just a little under a month ago. Yes, the Santa Susana Field Experiment Cover-Up is the name of the episode. And it just reminded me of the Silkwood issue. And I just wasn't sure if you guys had done an episode on that. So I was wondering if you haven't, if you'd be interested. I mean, everybody knows the, like, something gross happens to you or, you know, whatever. And you say, oh, I need to take a Silkwood shower. And I think a lot of people would be interested to know the origin of that. Anyway. Oh, my name's Victoria. Thanks. Bye.
You know, I was not personally familiar with this term, nor was I particularly familiar with the story behind the term, which we're going to get into a little bit. But Ben and Matt, you sort of hipped me to the fact that either you two or possibly me, and I have just completely spaced it out of my memory, have in fact discussed the story of Karen Silkwood, who was a laboratory analyst at a very important plutonium plant in the 1970s in Oklahoma. Miss Silkwood was a pretty well-known whistleblower who had some real issues with some of the safety measures that were in place at this particular lab that was known as the Kerr-McGee Corporation's Oil and Nuclear Complex in Oklahoma City. And Ms. Silkwood died under mysterious circumstances when her Honda hatchback ran off the road and into a ravine while she was on her way to do a very whistleblowery type interview with a reporter for the New York Times. Guys, did we do a full episode on the Silkwood incident, or was it something we just maybe discussed in relation to some other whistleblower type cases?
Well, you know, actually looking back through, we have not, at least to my knowledge, fully covered Karen Silkwood, but I know we have researched it and we've discussed it before. We've had people write into us previously to ask us to make this story, but I think it's going to be worth our time. There is a movie called Silkwood, by the way, that you can watch from 1983, if anyone is interested to get more info through your eyes and ears, I guess, rather than doing a bunch of reading.
Starring Cher as well, by the way. Yeah, it's true. Karen Silkwood's story is really interesting because she kind of changed her life because of her belief in nuclear energy. In the early 70s, she was a homemaker, a housewife, is what this article in Rolling Stone describes her as, from 1977. Karen Silkwood, The Case of the Activist Death by Howard Cohn. You can find that on the archives. Really great read. She divorced her husband, moved to Oklahoma City, and really wanted to get a job at this Kerr-McGee Corporation facility because this was a company that was on the cutting edge of using plutonium for nuclear reactions to create, you know, power. This was a big deal at the time. I mean, it was like, you know, referred to as like the age of atom. And it was later than when we're talking about with the Santa Susana lab and all of that. But this was definitely like they had been using uranium, but Kerr-McGee Corporation was on the cutting edge of making that move towards plutonium because it was more efficient, even though it was also more dangerous than uranium and also more rare and valuable. and there's a whole bunch of stuff wrapped up in this company. Robert Kerr, who's the founder, was actually the governor of Oklahoma, and he ran for president as a Democrat in 1952, and you know, was one of the most powerful human beings in the Senate at the time of his death. But essentially, Silkwood got the job because of her belief in this technology, and very quickly became kind of an outspoken advocate of safety and had some real problems with some of the conditions in this facility and was very outspoken about it, and was invited to join the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers International Union, the steering committee. She actually was elected and was asked to work undercover. So she would, you know, work late hours in this lab and using those things that you see in movies a lot, where it's the gloves that go inside the box, and that's how they would make these pellets of uranium, plutonium rather, that would go into the rods. And she would monitor her own levels of radiation and monitor the amounts of radiation that she would receive based on different conditions. And there's a lot more to it than that. But the point is, she believed that she was actually targeted because of her outspokenness and her kind of, you know, being a bit of a pill as far as management was concerned in raising some of these alarms. And she believed that she was purposefully contaminated with radiation. And there's a lot more to the story. Again, the film is a great place to start. And I do think we should go into a deeper dive on this topic. But the idea of a Silkwood shower is sort of a term that has carried on as a result of this. It's this idea of a shower that you know, a really long hot shower to decontaminate yourself from, like, being at a party where everyone's smoking cigarettes, or a campfire, or like really smelly foods or something. And it's just, I wasn't aware of the term. It's interesting how this is kind of the thing that the caller remembered as opposed to the story itself.
You know, Victoria, I greatly appreciate this call. And one of my favorite quotes from what you told us on your fellow conspiracy realist is when you said, everyone's heard the term Silkwood shower. I think a lot of people may have not heard that term. Was it familiar to you guys, Matt and Noel?
No, I'd never heard it.
I believe I've heard it in passing, but I was unsure. And I was never sure if it was referring to the death, essentially, how she was found in her vehicle, and it looked to have been a car accident, basically brought on by being drowsy from Quaaludes and cannabis. And I thought maybe that was the reference, but yeah, it makes way more sense when it goes back to what she realized was happening and the need to get clean or to feel clean. The whole scenario there of how she died is, I think, maybe worth our attention and some time.
That's right. There's a whole thing with the autopsy and finding the levels of radiation that were present in her blood when she was examined. But also there was even a former police officer by the name of A.O. Pipkin, who was a former cop from Albuquerque, who now at this time specialized in motor vehicle accidents. And he analyzed the scene independently and decided that there was a fresh ding on the rear bumper of Silkwood's Honda that was inconsistent with the report that indicated that she had just fallen asleep and drifted off the road. He thought it was more like a hit and run that could have been premeditated. And again, she was on the way to an interview with a New York Times reporter to share a dossier that she had been assembling about, you know, all of these conditions that she felt were unsafe and beyond. There is evidence that material was somehow kind of missing from the scene once the vehicle was impounded.
Yeah, and there's another note here that she received threatening phone calls just before she was involved in that accident. So I don't know, there's definitely some stuff going on here that's going to be worth our time. Oh, and by the way, there's a previous take of this conversation that you're hearing right now where I was talking about the China Syndrome, a movie, I believe from the 80s. And I would just want to point out, I wasn't incorrect, Noel. There is a death scene where a whistleblower is killed in the China Syndrome, and it is supposed to be based on the theorized version of Karen Silkwood's death.
Got it.
That's what I was thinking in my head.
Makes perfect sense. Yeah. So now we got two movies on the list. I actually haven't seen either Silkwood or The China Syndrome. And I think that would be great homework. And what do you say, fellas? Maybe we do a deeper dive episode on this whole story?
Sure thing. Agreed.
Well, with that, I think it's maybe time for one more quick break and then another listener message.
And we're back. There's one more fascinating call from your fellow conspiracy realist who identifies themselves as Agent K. Here's what you had to say, Agent.
Hi, calling for Matt, Ben, Noel, and Mr. Paul Deccant. I call him Mr. Paul Deccant because I've never heard his voice, so I feel like I don't know him, in which case I should address him as Mr. I'm calling to just float an idea for an episode topic, and that is, could humanity be under the influence of some sort of intelligent brain parasite that is influencing our behaviors and our emotions? I'm Agent K, and I'd like to stay anonymous, and thank you muchly.
Thanks so much for calling, Agent K. You have, whether by intention, design, or happy accident, stumbled onto one of my favorite big dilemmas of being a quote-unquote living thing, and that is this. One of the dirtiest secrets of the human species is that no one has a definition of intelligence that everyone agrees with. Are viruses intelligent? We haven't even figured out how to measure intelligence across all living things. We haven't even figured out if viruses qualify as living things themselves. For anyone who is a longtime listener, of course, I hope, fellow conspiracy realists, that toxoplasmosis popped in your head as soon as you heard the idea of human beings being controlled by an intelligent brain parasite. Toxoplasmosis is something that you can get from cats, and there is solid evidence that it will change your behavior as a human being when you contract this. So toxoplasmosis, Gandhi, can allegedly, there's pretty solid evidence that it can alter human behavior, but the big question is, to what degree can it alter behavior? It's been blamed for everything from making people more prone to quote-unquote mental illness, including schizophrenia, to making people more impulsive. There's been a ton of research behind this going back and forth, in the argument. But in an earlier video, Matt, that you and I did, we talked a lot about different mind-controlling parasites in mammals and insects, especially the specifically adapted ones that get particular species of insect and force them into behaviors meant to propagate the life of that virus or that bacteria or that parasite. I think we did real life pod people, something like that. Is that correct?
Yeah, we were. The one that I remember the most, and maybe this is different for you guys, is the one called Cordyceps that makes ants into zombies. I think it's Ophiocordyceps unilateralis, and it's a fungus that gets into ants pretty easily and ends up growing through their body and forces them to change their behavior to the extent that they go out to a very high place, stand, like they get very statue-like, and then the fungus proceeds to grow out of their head and creates more spores to get more creatures and just repeat.
And the spores burst.
Yeah.
There's also the cool parasite that becomes the tongue of certain types of marine animals. And then there's also the eye-eating thing for snails, I believe. The question is, especially if we're talking about a viral parasite, is it intelligent? Well, it depends on how you measure intelligence. Just like the earlier conversation that pleased all the huge population of myrmecologists in the audience are ants the most successful species? Is a virus one of the most intelligent living things? Because a virus only does a few things, but it does them very well. And it has a plan, a very specific plan. They adapt to their environment. They change themselves in order to survive. They do things that even experts do not expect. I mean, viruses can improvise, and improvisation is a tremendous mark of intelligence.
Well, and if anyone played the incredible game, The Last of Us, which there's a sequel out to now that's supposed to be heartbreaker and just fantastic, the zombie apocalypse in that game was brought on by something referred to in the game as cordyceps brain infection. And if you remember the way those zombies look, they have kind of these weird coral-like protrusions coming out of their faces and their heads. And that is sort of what it's based on. This is not something, thankfully, that the humans are susceptible to. What you were talking about, Matt and Ben, with the ants and those things that grow out of their heads. But it's an interesting creative use of something very bizarre and sci-fi-like in the animal kingdom.
So the big question here, Ben, Noel, if we are under the control of some kind of brain parasite, what behaviors are we doing that would be as a result of the parasite?
So that's an interesting question, Matt. If we take the case of Toxoplasma gondii, what we see is this condition, toxoplasmosis. If it affects behavior in living things, an infection, viral, fungal, what have you, bacterial, is going to seek to change behavior of a host such that it assists in the propagation of that parasitic life form. While that looks very space-agey and sci-fi and terrifying at times, or darkly fascinating, it's completely understandable. It's a plot twist for the host, but it's by the book for the parasite. So one great example, the human stuff is still controversial because as a species, we're very self-centered, which oddly enough, really messes with our research into humans for a number of reasons that I won't go into in today's episode. So let's take an example of another living thing that's affected by T. gondii. Rats infected with this parasite behave very differently than rats who are uninfected. Imagine if you're a rat, not in the gangster or mafia sense. Imagine if you were a small mammal, a rat.
Got it. I'm a double crosser. I understand.
Usually, right, you're going to be terrified of predators like cats, you know, or other omnivorous mid-sized mammals or giants to you. But if you are infected with T. gondii, your behavior changes. You are sexually aroused by the smell of cats and you approach them in an amorous manner. This is real. This is a conspiracy that this infection gives to rats. And then, of course, the cat kills you, eats you. Well, it probably tortures you first because it's a cat. And then, boom, T. gondii has hacked the cat system. And then the cat excretes, you know, its feces, right? And the life, you know, circle of life, cue the Elton John song. It's all happening again in a very ugly way. So the question is not can these infections alter behavior, human behavior, or the behavior of other living things. The question is, what else is out there? What else do we have to discover? How long do we have before something else evolves?
Yeah, and look, I mean, not to get too alarmist or sci-fi about it, but even with this novel coronavirus, we know that viruses can evolve to do things differently than they have done in the past. And you know, you got to knock wood that we have not seen a cordyceps type virus that does, you know, jump from ants to humans, or a version of T. Gandhi that, like, say, makes us jump out in front of buses or something, you know? I mean, but who knows, given a long enough timeline, what these crazy viruses will do.
So I got two quick things. Fascinating thing with cordyceps that I'm just reading back through this. There's an Atlantic article from 2017 that's talking about cordyceps in particular. And one of the most fascinating things about this fungus, because it is a fungus that, you know, begins as a single cell and then a colony begins and it grows throughout the body. And it seems to work together as one thing, a superorganism. It is able to control the body of that ant without getting fungal cells into the brain of the ant whatsoever. It actually specifically stays away from the brain. That, to me, is mind-boggling that that could be true. That the control mechanism wouldn't be at the place where the neurons get active, or, you know, where the decisions are made, right? It would seem as though the brain would be the place where all of the changing in behavior occurs. But this appears to occur in several other species and parasitic animal or parasitic organisms that attack other organisms. That, to me, that's one, right? Number two, and I'm going to go full sci-fi with this, no stops here. What if the parasitic organism is some kind of AI or advanced AI that has yet to be born, that is being born right now, that is manipulating us all to do what we're doing right now, sitting in front of a computer, talking into a mechanized eye that is listening to us as we talk to each other from long distances?
I'll see that. I'll raise you. I'll go further.
Yes.
Because one thing that this is related in my mind to the idea of defining intelligence. We also don't do the best job at defining life or sentience. Think of the idea of meme, which is just a unit of an idea, right? Is an idea alive? We know that, for instance, people can be infected with ideology. Let me walk this comparison out a little bit. It can change people's behavior, often in a way that is deleterious to their biological imperative, which is only to survive long enough to reproduce. What I'm saying is, you know, artificial intelligence or parasite, fungal, bacterial, viral, or an idea. Could an idea be a life form, somehow sentient, somehow sapient of its own, just without a corporeal form, other than the brains in which it resides? And if it resides in those brains, right, then that makes the brain very much a host to something possibly parasitic. That's like, that's how far I'm going out with this, man, you know? but also the idea of a AI that somehow exists cognitively beyond linear time, that is creating its own Bethlehem to slouch toward, you know, that's fascinating too. But yeah, I love the idea, or I am fascinated and horrified by the idea that the mind-controlling parasites we're talking about here, Agent K, might not just be, you know, the garden variety meat and potatoes, bacteria, virus, fungus. Maybe it's something completely non-physical. Do we not say it's so many periods throughout human civilization? It is, you know, dulce et decorum est pro patria mori. It is sweet and noble to die for one's country. That's directly against the biological imperative. We're dying for ideas. Ideas are controlling us the same way that cordyceps will control an ant.
Yeah, and an idea can be wrong, you know, or it can be one that does not fundamentally serve us as a people if we go down the wrong path and believe the wrong individuals in power that are, let's say, cult leaders, for example. Let's say a suicide cult. That's a mimetic, you know, viral idea that people are infected with that then decide it's a good idea to die for that person's ideology, like Jonestown or like the Heaven's Gate cult or whatever. Those are all things that are fundamentally opposed to our biological imperative, right?
Yeah, or something as simple as you can't see it, but I'm in my mind holding up a $1 bill. Just the viral thought that this is the most important thing that you can do and strive for and do whatever it takes to make more of these, to have these.
Well, my question for you is, Matt, what's it going to take for me to get that dollar bill that you're holding right now?
Well, it's pretty easy. Deliver me a pizza and I will give it to you as part of your tip. Because I really want some pizza right now. Please.
Done. I have sort of a tombstone type pizza.
Callback
to Alexis, super producer's potential new nickname.
And so thank you, Anonymous. Thank you, Victoria. Thank you, Agent K. And thank you to everyone listening. You, specifically you, fellow conspiracy realist. Would you like to take a page from your fellow listeners or a phone number from your fellow listeners or an email address? We are going to continue this listener mail segment for the foreseeable future, which means we need your help and we cannot wait to hear from you. You can find us all over the internet. We're on Facebook, we're on Instagram, we're on Twitter. If you are Facebook inclined, we always love to recommend our favorite community page on Facebook. Here's where it gets crazy.
And you don't even need a dollar to get into that one. All you need is a name. Either Ben's, Matt's, mine, Alexis Tombstones, or Paul Mission Controls. Or you don't even need a name. You just need an idea. But it needs to be one that we recognize as being somehow gleaned from this particular podcast. Or just let us know that you know what the thing is. Some people aren't real people. And that's really all we're trying to do, is figure out who the real people are.
Yes. Keep those non-person thought parasites away from our social pages, if possible. Thank you. If you don't want to use social media, you can give us a call. Our number is 1-833-STDWYTK. We are officially through the messages into July now. It's official, everybody. We're getting closer and closer to being one with the timing of the messages. We will get there very soon. Just give us a call. Let us know what you think and let us know if you're cool with us using your audio on the air. If you don't want to do that, we got one last way for you to contact us.
Why not send us a good old-fashioned email? We are
conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.